Hi, welcome to Outrageous, our bi-weekly podcast where we talk about race, culture, media, politics, and everything in between. My name is Chris. I'm in New York City, and I am joined by my two very best friends, Trisha, who is also in New York City, right here with me right now.
Hey. Hi!
And Jason calling in from D.C. Hi, Jason.
Hey there.
So we took the show on the road. We were all in D.C. last week, and now we're in New York. Invited Jason. He was like, I want nothing to do with the two of you. So we're here doing it on our own.
It was my son's birthday party yesterday, which was
fun.
Thank you. It was actually great. It was great fun.
How old is he now?
He will be 7 next Saturday.
Wow, that's too old.
What does a 7-year-old birthday party look like now?
Well, he wanted it at Chuck E. Cheese's, so we can all visualize that.
The eighth circle of hell.
Can anyone leave with diseases?
Can I just say, Chuck E. Cheese is a terrible idea. Like, you get filthy children, right? And you put them in that weird indoor play space. So they're having pizza, they're having Coke, they're having lemonade. They've got crap all over their hands. They crawl into that thing.
Well,
right,
that,
which inside
so
must
wrong.
Look like
it shows it's been too long since you've been in a Chuck E. Cheese's. That's gone.
Oh, really? They took it out? Probably because they
at
found
least,
like old bodies in there.
Yeah, probably they did.
The worst would be like kids would go in there, and then the parents would be helpless. They'd be like, "It's time to go," and they'd be standing there. Hey, Amanda, it's time to go.
Like, can you see her face? Like, I can't see her. Is her hand? That's her hand. Is that her hand? Is that someone else's hand?
No, but seriously, did they get rid of it because of a lawsuit? Because that thing was an accident waiting to happen.
I don't know, but it's not there anymore, and it's slightly more sanitary now than it used to be. Yeah.
I mean, I think the benefit of Chuck E. Cheese is that they create a disaster elsewhere.
What do you mean?
Not in your house.
Yeah, no, that's the benefit of doing it as a birthday party there. The other thing, yesterday, it just so happened, it was literally like 110 degrees in D.C. with the humidity. And so I think everyone was like very grateful to be in like an air-conditioned space.
Absolutely. We spent the day at the Metropolitan Museum of Art because we were like, what's a beautiful space that will be totally air-conditioned that we can hang out for hours without anyone bothering us? And we saw some great works of art. But mostly we sat on benches and were like, oh, God, this air conditioning.
That's awesome.
Oh, it was pretty awesome.
It was humid the whole damn day.
Yeah. You know what it's like when you can't stop sweating?
Yeah.
You're sweating and you're like, if only I could stop sweating, but
and you're only sweating from standing.
Yeah.
Right.
Just
yeah.
Not doing anything.
Not even. Sometimes we were sitting.
So painful.
But you know, it was a really gorgeous day. We had so much fun.
It was one of those days where we just tooled around and chatted.
When we were younger, in New York, you know, before we reached this advanced age, we used to just walk into around neighborhoods, just walk through the streets, look in people's homes.
No.
You want to say no on the podcast? Anyway, we peek through people's windows to see their fancy apartments. Don't pretend like that's not
true.
Oh,
well, that.
Well,
sure.
Yeah,
it
absolutely.
Made it seem like we were sneaking into people's homes. That's
that,
a whole different kind of
thing. There was that one time. There was that one time, remember? We'll tell that story a different time. Okay, well, let's get started.
All right.
So we were back to the regular format. We have three topics. And the first person who's going to go is going to be me today. This has been burning my brain for the longest time. This Lena Dunham controversy, her imagined rejection by Odell Beckham Jr. at the Met Gala Awards. So if you haven't heard what's happened yet, Lena Dunham, I suppose, was interviewing fellow white girl Amy Schumer for some publication or something. And in the course of that interview, Lena Dunham expresses that she sat next to Odell Beckham Jr., who is some sort of sportsing person.
Sportsing! Another new verb.
He does sportsing for a living. And she sat next to him at the Met Gala. She did not know him. She did not speak to him. But in her conversation with Amy Schumer, she unfolds this entire drama that existed in her head about how Odell Beckham Jr. must have taken one look at her, decided that he didn't want to fuck her, and then he, again, this is all in her head, called her a marshmallow and a dog and a child, and went on and on and on, and then something about how she was rejected by him. Meanwhile, Odell Beckham Jr. was like playing Angry Birds on his phone, right? No idea. So this goes viral. Because, again, Lena Dunham is being called out as the worst kind of white feminist, right? Because whenever she says these racist things, she hides behind the fact that I'm a white feminist. And I guess what I want to talk to you about today is, yes, this situation with Odell Beckham Jr., because I think it's fascinating the way it played out. But I want to talk about white feminism as it stands, because I really think that as a movement, they fail, and they're built to fail. Like, white women are never going to overthrow their husbands, their sons, and their fathers. It's not in their best interest to do so. What do you guys think about this Dunham thing?
Wait. Can you talk a little bit more about that last part of what you just said? Like, why isn't it in their best interest to overthrow their husbands, fathers, brothers?
So in our culture, race is the dominant narrative. We get privilege based on race more than we do other things. White women are in a particular bind because they directly benefit from white supremacy because their fathers are white and their husbands are white and their sons will be white. Now, they have less access than the men in their culture and society. So they decide they want the access. However, they want it only to a certain point. They can't upset the status quo too much. So they can't actually storm the halls of power and disrupt them in any way because they don't want other people in there. They don't want people of color in there. They don't want other women of color in there. They want white women have a glorified position in our society. They are the ones to be protected. You know, they're the special snowflakes. They want to have some of the power that white men have, but maintain their special snowflake status. It's a fake minority, honestly. And nothing to say that women aren't struggling with issues that women struggle with. I'm just saying that white women are in this particular bind. And the reason why the Dunham thing comes in for me, it's because I think Dunham is a perfect example of what the problem with white feminism is. She is on record saying terrible things about race. She over-sexualizes black men like it's nothing, like it is her job. And then when people come for her, other white feminists say like, oh, but she's advanced. She's a woman and she's saying what she's thinking and this is important and we need to pay attention. And her lack of attention to intersectionality, like a lot of white feminists, I think is actually more damaging than good.
Yeah, and what you've laid out is very interesting because I think with any group, there's this tension between that group is trying to get more power. Now, just basic strategy would say the more allies they have, the more likely they will be successful. However, joining with allies that may also at some point become or may already be competitors for more power. I haven't really thought about this before, but I think what you're laying out is a very interesting kind of, I don't know, political science conundrum. And that's without, you know, obviously I'm not commenting on I'm not like issuing any judgment yet at this point about like Lena Dunham or anything, but just that's an interesting problem you're laying out, and I'm like thinking about that. I'm reminded of, and this is very different, but I'm reminded of, you know, there are black feminists who reflect on the civil rights movement and black feminists who were in the civil rights movement where there was this tension, you know, where you had a movement that was primarily male-led. You had, I think, black feminists in that movement saying, we need to also be talking about sexism. We need to make sure that black female voices are, you know, leading just as much as black male voices. And I think there are, like, anecdotes of, like, that, you know, there being a real conflict there, that there were black male voices saying, if we try to do too many things at once, we're going to lose it all. So, like, let the men lead on this. You know, that's a more acceptable normative dynamic in American society, that the men dominate. So let's, like, get the power for us as black people, and then we can work out the gender politics. And then,
but that's,
you know,
different. I mean, that's different because those women are black, right? It's white women, you know, because race being the dominant narrative, it's a very fine line to walk, where it's like we want gender parity. However, we want gender parity. So we're going to use the vocabulary of civil rights. We're going to use the vocabulary of letting people in and like a bigger tent, etc. However, at the same time, that tent really can't get bigger for other people or other minorities. We just want more access to the power that our men have. And then we want to consolidate and hold it ourselves. It's really different from what you're saying in sort of like the male-led black civil rights movement. Like, you're right. Like, it was sort of, yes, women, you're going to have to wait. Let the men get the power, and then it will trickle down to you. But the fact that there are already disadvantaged women, I think, and the fact that they are black women, I think plays into it differently than the white women.
Sure. No, I
because I agree. At the end of the day, the white women have a lot to lose, and black people in general have to fight, have to punch their way up.
And they have less to lose.
Because white women are trying to punch their way up and punch down to keep others out.
I mean, I think it's been useful for the last couple of years for us to tackle intersectionality, because I think we have often failed to consider this particular bind around feminism. I think we assumed for a while, at least in mainstream media or mainstream sort of propagation of ideas, that feminism was about equality for women, all women. And I think one of the things we haven't done often is allow white women to talk about their own privilege. And so what ends up happening is that when they open their mouths to talk about their own experiences, they're often given a bye because there is an assumption that they are equally oppressed as other women, and that they, in some sense, have something in common with people of color, and so they can sort of have a more wider berth. Because I think that's what happens with Lena Dunham. Often Lena Dunham will do things, and it's not just Lena Dunham. I actually think that, who's the woman that does 30 Rock?
Tina Fey.
Tina Fey does the exact same thing. She has egregious ideas out there. And anytime she's sort of challenged about her lack of intersectionality, she responds like white men do when white feminists raise their issues. She's often very dismissive and just, oh, everyone's so sensitive.
Yeah.
That's usually been her response. And so I think that they just have very little practice in honoring and recognizing their privilege. Because I think what you really want to say, Chris, is that white women don't want to give up white supremacy because
not.
They benefit from white supremacy.
Of course, they're white women.
Yes, they're white women.
Of course.
But it's never been explicitly said like that. Mm-hmm. We always want to assume that white women are potential collaborators on this civil rights journey, but they're not, mm-hmm. because they are beneficiaries of white supremacy. And so that's why when you have kind of white women kind of lead the charge around equality, you have to sort of hold them to the fire, because you have to recognize that they're marching to basically gain equality with white men.
And the thing
white
is
that, men, not like, men, white men.
And the idea that white feminists would challenge or feel like they have any solidarity with black women or women of color is as silly to think that like white men in power are going to try to advocate for black men. Like that sort of thing sounds odd to our ears, but the idea that women as a group have goals that are universal to women, that's ridiculous.
Well, it's not ridiculous. I just think that it's just
okay.
I mean, because it's not ridiculous only because you've said in that statement, you've introduced the idea that white men would even be thinking about black men.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what I mean? But
I'm sorry to interrupt, but let me just dig down deeper in that. The idea about white men advocating for black men, I guess to finish my thought, is that that's super ridiculous to me, is because white men's power is based on keeping black men down. And so there's no reason to believe that that same equivalency doesn't exist for white women and black people and black women in particular.
Well, I think the reason why that, and Jason, I think you should probably toss in here. I think one of the things that we haven't talked about, though.
Ever?
Is that, no, I don't, not ever.
Okay.
But I think one of the things that we haven't talked about is kind of sexism, right? Because one of the things that we often assume is that white women are fighting against men, right? And inclusive of that are black men. And so that's why when they take certain arguments, like whenever they sexualize black men or do something like that, they're given a pass because it's seen as attacking, quote unquote, this overall group of men.
Yeah.
Not recognizing that in kind of a hierarchy of power, they have more power than black men. They don't see themselves in that way.
Mm-hmm.
They don't. And so, which is why oftentimes
like what happened with Obama becoming president, mm-hmm. people were quick to say, oh, well, we clearly don't have a problem with black men becoming president because that was the first quote-unquote minority person, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And so that kind of legitimatized the claim that white women are sort of in a tier of power underneath other men of color, which is ridiculous mm-hmm. in the practical sense.
Well, that's what I'm saying. It's ridiculous. But it's not, it's in our general culture, like practically, we don't view it as ridiculous. White women listening to this, white women in the room would be like, oh, but that's not ridiculous. Like that's absolute truth, but it's not. It's because white women don't not see their privilege in the same way.
It's because of white supremacy. Yeah. First, you have to assume, well, you know, one of the things that I think happens, I'm sorry, Jason, is that...
Jason, we swear to God we're going to let you talk.
One of the things that happens is that
oppressed right now. Well,
I know,
are
you feeling oppressed?
That on the totem pole, white men have fallen below black men and women.
Me and Trish will take shots of it later. Go ahead.
But I think when we start introducing these topics around civil rights and issues, I think that black feminists have been the one to hold white feminists' feet to the fire around white supremacy. Because when white feminists were attempting to gain equal rights, they didn't attack white supremacy. And they didn't also expand their idea about their lack of access or whatever they're fighting for, and they didn't include white supremacy as part of the discussion. They just simply said, I want the same rights as my husband, father, son, blah, de, blah, de, blah, de. And that's what they were aiming for. It's been other women of color that have had to say, wait a minute, mm-hmm. you need to understand that this is an intersectional issue. And I think that's why we've sort of historically been behind the eight ball on that.
I think these are really interesting points. I would make a couple points.
Thank you, Jason.
Sure. Yeah. Good job, guys. I would make a couple points. So one, you know, if you look prior to women's suffrage, women getting the right to vote, I mean, it may be, and I haven't thought about it enough, but it may be that 100 years ago, there was a broader set of issues or rights that did fall more along the lines of gender than race. But it's hard for me to think of any like that now. So I just want to put that out there. Like, I wonder whether in early American feminism, maybe there was a little bit more legitimacy to there being some issues along the lines of gender or sex.
Well, voting. Let's talk about voting for a second.
Yeah, voting.
Think about voting. Like, white women in the early part of the 20th century wanted the vote. Did they want it for all women?
Nope.
Right?
Because black women, even though the 19th Amendment passed in 1920, mm-hmm. white and black women did not have equal access to the right to vote because black women were disenfranchised in the South. And so many black women weren't able to exercise that right to vote until the 1960s. And I didn't see sort of the women's suffrage movement pushing hard to make sure that happened.
No, that's certainly
when they
true.
The right to vote, it was really about white women.
Mm-hmm. Everything that both of you have said, I think there's a ton of validity.
Yeah.
I think there's a ton of validity too, but part of the dynamic and part of the problem is about, like, you know, white acknowledgement, white consciousness, right? Of like, my guess is total speculation that if you asked, you know, in 1910, if you asked a woman who was advocating for, you know, the women's right to vote and said, do you want it equally for white and black women? They'd probably say yes. And many of them were probably, you know,
why are you certain of that?
Yeah,
why
would
are you certain
be
of that in 1910?
Well, simply because
I mean, we have people today, like cops are killing black people, and white people still like, well, I mean, so I don't know, like, why would you think that over 100 years ago that white women have that sort
would
of
would see an even
idea
allegiance with white with black women?
I'm not saying they would see an allegiance. I'm saying simply, if one were to ask, you know, a woman like that the question of, do you think black women should have the right to vote? Because black men already had it in policy. I'm not talking about in practice, but in policy, you know, I would think that, well, yeah, of course. Obviously, if women need the right to vote, that's going to include black women. That's not to say that that's enough, or that there that you know were white women doing things to actually make sure that black women were going to actually be able to vote. Clearly, they weren't. You know, I think what you've been saying, Tricia, about whether you know white women have had to think about dynamics along the lines of race and white privilege. I mean, generally speaking, most white people, in my experience, are not conscious of white privilege and like don't have trouble even understanding. I mean, I know white people who work, you know, in fields where they're advocating particularly for equity and more equitable things. And I've had conversations where someone will say, I still don't understand the term white privilege. Like, and I mean, I'm thinking there's this one guy in particular, white guy, and he spends every day, like, really working on behalf of black kids and education, but he said, like, I grew up dirt poor in Nebraska, and I don't understand it. And this was a conversation. We were all white men in the conversation, and a couple of us, you know, were trying to give examples of how, like, clearly you had huge struggles, and not to take away from that, but you know, do you get followed around convenience stores? Were you stopped by the police disproportionately? Like all these other things, and I just think those conversations don't happen nearly enough. So I'm all that to say.
So you can't prove a negative. This is I'm always exhausted by what people say. This you just can't prove a negative. Like I can't explain to someone what it's like that every time I see the NYPD get out of a car, like something goes up my spine. Like, and if it doesn't happen to you, like you don't know it's not happening to you.
Well, that's
you know
it. What I mean? That's it. Also, well, that's right. And I think that's.
I do think that we have to tackle that question, because I think it comes up often, and if it comes up often enough, then that's clearly a hole in people's understanding.
Right.
Which is that people assume, and especially poor whites assume that their individual poverty equates to the poverty of groups of people.
But also, they think it is indicative of the systemic nature of their poverty.
But that's what I'm saying. Yeah. What I'm saying is they're assuming my individual poverty means that there's no such thing as a systemic effort to subjugate other groups of people. Because I was poor. And guess what? LeBron James is richer than me. Right. And so they don't really understand sort of the systemic nature of groups of people being systematically held back by laws. Not recognizing that there isn't a law set in place to ensure that you remain poor. Mm-hmm. But there were laws set in place to make sure that black people remained outside of opportunities. And that's what we mean when we talk about white privilege. And that's what we mean when we talk about systemic racism, is that it's not your individual, my family was poor. Mm-hmm. What that means is that if you can gain access, you'll be able to move through that system because you're white. But if I'm able to gain access, there will still be stumbling blocks that are legal ones that will get in my way. That's really the distinction. And
legal,
I don't think
cultural, social.
Yeah. You can change your name as a white person if you feel like you're going to be held back because of maybe Polish ancestry or something.
That's
like
that.
You can change your name. Mm-hmm. You can craft a whole new narrative and enter new spaces.
And the fact that that's available and the fact that that is something that white people have done show that they have an understanding of white privilege.
But you have to make that explicit.
I would disagree with that, though, only insofar that when you say that, Chris.
Yeah.
You're assuming that they're thinking about the people who can't do that. But
yeah, they're not.
Probably not. Like, it doesn't even occur. I mean,
I suppose, but I guess my point is, you're right. Like, maybe it wouldn't occur to them, but it illustrates white privilege. The fact that white people are like, well, I'll change my name and have access. You're right. They're probably not thinking about people who don't have access and reflecting on their own privilege. But just the fact that those thoughts exist and they do those things is completely illustrative of white privilege.
Well, and I agree. And
they understand that power is available to them, and all they have to do is go to court and sign a piece of paper. And it doesn't occur to them that I can't go to court or, you know, and lighten my skin and change my features and my ancestry. Well,
look, I mean, and I think for a lot of the groups of white ethnics that we're talking about, this is why the United States has been such a great place to come to. Like, you know, my great-grandparents and grandparents were, you know, quite poor. My grandfather had a junkyard and, you know, spoke Yiddish, and like, but they were able to come, and within a generation or two, you know, because of our white skin, we've had access to power that black people haven't had for generations. Like, that's exactly why this is, you know, Ellis Island was such a great place for the folks we're talking about, you know, including, like, my ancestors to come to. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, when I think about this, and I feel like so many of our conversations end with, like, we need better education. I've been in, like, really phenomenal, mind-blowing race equity sessions, and I feel like if you could take people like Lena Dunham and Tina Fey and a lot of folks we're talking about and actually sit them down and walk them through the history of policy in this country and how it's played out, we could all agree that maybe this should not be the case, and we can decide who to assign blame to. But I think a lot of it is just ignorance. Like, I think a lot of the white feminists we're talking about just are ignorant as to how these things have actually played out and continue to play out in our society.
So here's my question then. Do we educate them?
Well...
Yes.
Well, can I just say that there was another part of this that we didn't even hit. Mm. When I read the Lena Dunham story, mm-hmm. the first thing I thought about was Emmett Till. Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, in case people don't know, you know, Emmett Till is the 14-year-old that was murdered by two white men because one of the white men's wives claimed that this 14-year-old
called her or whistled at her?
Catcalled at her. No, catcalled her, groped her, and essentially touched her in a store when apparently I think he was prodded by his buddies to flirt with her, and all he did, I think, was go into the store and say, "Bye, ma'am." That was supposedly what he did. But when the full two days later, the woman claimed that he walked into the store, groped her, mm-hmm. and the men came, pulled this young boy out of his family's house, and murdered him. Yeah. His face was beaten to a pulp, so disfigured that his parents could not recognize him. So as soon as I read the Lena Dunham story, I thought about that specific tale. But then the reality was that the flirting or all of the elements was in that white woman's mind.
Yep.
And if it was a different time, and Lena told that very same story, a group of men could have felt empowered to go into that man's house and pull him out and kill him. Mm-hmm. Because guess what? Those men were tried in a segregated jury and found not guilty. Mm-hmm. So by virtue of her even calling herself a feminist, and supposedly kind of keyed into subjugation and suppression, she should be understanding that this is not the kind of story you tell.
But that's along race lines, and I think that's...
But it's not even... But
yes, it is, because it's what Jason's saying. It's an ignorance about these issues.
But you know what? What I wanted to do, even before I got into the race piece, I wanted her to admit that the story was about her own insecurities.
She did. She did, only in the apology later.
What she should have said was, in telling the story, she should have immediately followed the story by saying, but of course, this was all in my mind, and then admit her own insecurities. But she just left the story. And then in her apology, she proceeded to talk about the fact that she feels ugly in those privileged spaces with other white women who are more beautiful than she is. So she essentially indicted this black man based on her own insecurities. And it just made me think how...
It's dangerous.
That it's a dangerous precedent.
Sure.
Because this has happened in the past where a white woman felt empowered to say whatever, whether it was true or not. And because these white men felt it was their need to protect this white flower, mm-hmm. they went and they had the power of the state behind them to go and lynch black men.
I'm going to tell you guys a story. So this happened when I was in middle school. We were in class, and I can't remember what led up to it, but it was a whole bunch of kids just goofing off, and I snapped this girl's bra. Other people were doing it. Oh, I know now it's inappropriate, and mm-hmm. if I heard the 13-year-old, I'd be like, stop that. You know, I understand now it's inappropriate, but at the time, like, given the context, it was something that was going on. I, the next day, got called down to the principal's office. Just me. And the school was mostly white. I think there were two other black kids in that school. And I came down to the office, and there's the girl's parents, and the girl, and the principal. And this girl, who is a friend of mine, is now looking terrified.
Yes.
And I'll never, ever forget that, because when I went home, and I had talked to my parents, who were not present at this meeting.
Which should have been.
When I talked to my parents about this, we had a long conversation, which I won't share here, but what came out of it was the fact that, and it was the Emmett Till thing, about how I had to be careful around white women, a lesson that I stick with today. And this might sound ridiculous. When I'm on the subway and it's crowded, I make damn sure that I'm not standing near a white woman today. Because at the end of the day, I know whatever she says goes. Whatever she says happens to her, happened to her. And that's a really, really messed up space to be in. And the whole Lena Dunham thing, I think this is why I'm obsessed with it, is because her power, just like that woman in the Emmett Till case, her lack of understanding over her ability to control life or death or success or ruin, she's so oblivious to it. She is an extremely dangerous person to be around.
Yes, she is.
Like, black people at parties, famous
avoid
black people,
her.
Listen to me.
Avoid
everyone
her.
Within the reach of my voice. Avoid Lena Dunham. She will ruin you because she's a white woman who is completely
clueless.
Ignorant and clueless over how she affects the world around her.
But not just that. She's also victimizing herself. And because she doesn't recognize her own power, she will use her own victimization to lead to your downfall.
Even in her apology, she victimized.
Yeah.
She's a victim of these quote-unquote swan-like actresses who are prettier than her. Bitch, in one way, this was never about you. Like, you could have caused some serious damage.
Yep.
But she's still ignorant of it.
No, because she essentially centered herself only. This is woe is me. I'm not thin. And so this is why she's going to gain white feminist sympathy, because white feminists understand the body image issue. And so they're going to key into that and not recognize that because of her privilege, she failed. She failed to take another person's individuality into consideration.
And the other thing, like just one corner of this, and then we can move on to this. I guess I'm glad I'm talking about this because I didn't realize how angry I was about
you
it.
You are very angry.
This has been on my mind nonstop. Like,
because you're a black man, and you interact with white women often.
Yes, and I have to be very careful about the way that I do it all of the time. So what also pissed me off is the fact that, first of all, she's a victim right here, and because there's other women more beautiful. And what I read in that in the context was that, so if she was more beautiful, if she was Charlize Theron, then she would have a different kind of power over this black man sitting next to her.
And that's what she was upset about.
So either she wanted to be more beautiful and have this power where she's irresistible to him sexually, but since she doesn't have that, then she can decry him and call him some sort of like, she can feel rejection by him. And I just, there was no way out for Odell Beckham Jr. there. Like, he was, in her mind, there was just no way out. Like, he was an object that either she can obtain or destroy. And I think you're right. As a black man, I found that particularly disgusting. I think she's disgusting. There, I said it. My anti-recommendation is Lena Dunham. Everything to do with her, avoid it.
My anti-recommendation is avoid anyone who doesn't recognize their privilege, because what can happen to you when
just
you
get on a boat and leave
certain
this
spaces, it's potentially
you want to avoid
dangerous.
People who are not conscious of their privilege, you are in the wrong country. I'm sorry to say.
I know. You know what it is?
Stay in that apartment and never leave, because you are not going to find a place in this country where you can avoid.
You know what it is? I don't avoid. I think what I do is, I'll tell you this. This is a personal insight into Trisha.
There we go.
I know.
New segment.
Having those people. No, I avoid having those people in my inner circle.
Oh, well,
it
of
is,
course.
No, but it's something I'm active about that.
Absolutely.
I actively avoid putting people like that in my inner circle because I know that I'm not safe with them.
we're saying a lot of personal things here in public, as it were. But
that's what it is.
But hell, it's our podcast.
That's when race becomes personal.
Yeah, as black people, Trisha.
You have to be very careful.
We have to be very careful about that. And it's. I mean, obviously, I have white friends, obviously. It just has to be handled differently. The conversations, the spaces that we enter, the way that we interact in those spaces, it's something that has to be thought about in a way that I don't always think about.
This is when politics becomes personal.
Personal, absolutely. And I think it's a lot of times that white people who have black friends, they don't understand that.
Which is why when I sense that, I say, no, I will not be going to you to this neighborhood where I might get killed and you're going to act like a fool and leaving me vulnerable.
But I live here and it's fine and everyone treats me fine. And, you know, it's like, well, no, but I'm trying to tell you that the world doesn't begin and end on your say-so.
Yeah.
Like, it's not your experience is not indicative of anything other than your experience with me. But I have an experience with the world that you exist in and benefit from outside of you. And that the ignorance of that, ignorance is a strong word, but no, there it is. The ignorance of that is something that as black people, we have to really look out for, because at the end of the day, when shit goes down, it's me getting shot in the back, you know, 9 times in self-defense because I look like a monster. And that's the end of that. Jason, you have the last word on this because we barely let you talk.
Okay, no, so, yeah, Jackie's going to be very upset. So just
like
two things.
I like how we're calling out individual listeners.
I know. I love it.
Go ahead.
So two things I would say. One is I'm going to try to bring as many of these people into my inner circle, and I'm going to educate their asses. So that's my takeaway from this conversation.
That's what you should do as a white person. Leave black people
out of exactly. It. No, I know. Yeah. Exactly. But I do want to say that I agree with everything you two said. I was impressed with the apology, and it doesn't erase any of the problems you identified. And, again, I don't disagree with anything you said. The fact that she did acknowledge the racial problems of the way she was viewing him, the fact that she did say that they were her own insecurities and that she even used the word narcissistic, I was actually impressed with the apology. And I just say that in the context of we have become such an apology-free society where, like, people don't apologize, or when they do, it's like, I'm sorry that, you know, I'm sorry you feel that way. So I did think, as an articulated apology over social media, like, it was a rare specimen, but doesn't erase everything else you guys said.
Let's move on to Jason. I want to hear, let's hear about what you have to say.
So I've struggled, I feel like, throughout my life, understanding the value of much of what NASA does. Very different topic.
Damn, NASA.
Very different topic. But this is, you know, this is a topic, like, I really don't know where either of you, as I was trying to think of topics, I kept thinking of things, I'm like, oh, we're just going to agree about that. We're just going to agree about that. And I actually don't know where you two stand on this, because I don't think we've discussed it, so I'm really interested. So, you know, I heard this story recently on NPR, that there's this goal at NASA, I think Obama said it, that, like, we're going to get on Mars by the 2030s or something. And so what we're working on right now, or what NASA is working on, is plucking a boulder, a car-sized boulder from an asteroid, bringing it into the lunar orbit, and then sending astronauts up to study it. And then there's debate. There are some people saying, yeah, this will really help us as we progress towards landing on Mars. And there are other former NASA folks who are like, this will not help at all. What does a boulder from an asteroid have to do with landing on Mars? And, you know, they're saying it's going to cost $2 billion to do this boulder plucking project. I feel like I'm generally a pro-knowledge person. Like, I do believe knowledge for its own sake is useful, and I'm for that. And I'm for us as taxpayers investing in acquisition of knowledge that can be helpful. I want to know from you two whether you see any value. I don't think that it seems worthwhile to me, given the expense of time and money and energy, to ever land on Mars. And therefore, I definitely don't think it's worth $2 billion to pluck a boulder from an asteroid and study it as it goes around the moon. I'd love to hear what you two think about this stuff.
So you want to talk about NASA's value to us as a culture and society and Mars. But really, what I'm going to seize your topic and talk about is...
That was fast.
Yeah, what I'm going to seize your topic and talk about, because I think it's relevant, is the poor state of science reporting in our culture. The idea that you are asking, you don't see the value of NASA, just shows right away that the value of NASA has been made, it hasn't been made apparent to you.
Can I just clarify? I'm not saying the value of NASA. I'm saying the value of these particular projects, landing on Mars and studying this asteroid
border. So what I'm saying is, like, if you dig around on the internet, if you think back to the initial moon landing, when you think about where we were then and where we are technologically today, it all doesn't come out of the space stuff and the moon landing, but a tremendous amount of it does. You cannot get out of bed in the morning without touching a piece of technology that comes to that is a derivative of the technology that was developed for all these space adventures we've
had.
That's true.
That's true.
I mean, from your cell phone to your alarm clock to all sorts of technology. So I guess, I mean, we can talk about Mars and stuff, but I just want to point out that we have so many institutes and universities and think tanks, like, generating so much science news, so many important discoveries, many breakthroughs, and so much of that is invisible to us as lay people. Like, we don't understand how we get the things that we get. We only know that, you know, the iPhone 7 is now going to have these new magical headphones, but we don't actually think about the technology that frees them from wires. You know, we don't think about how ATMs work. We don't think about, you know, how our food is refrigerated. You know, we don't think about how it's possible that we can have advance warning about Hurricane Sandy and prepare. And the idea that that is not connected to anything, I think, is an education problem. So now to return to your thing, like, is you don't see the value of landing on Mars and plucking a car-sized boulder from the moon? You're right. You don't see it. And that's the problem, because there is absolutely value to those things. Landing on Mars is going to change our life as we know it, or your children's lives as they know it. Like, the advances in technology, the way that we're going to have to push ourselves to get there, and the things that we're going to learn about our own planet, space, gravity, matter, time, is going to fundamentally change humanity. But you're right. The fact that you don't see the value of that, I do think, is an absolute problem.
Now, I think all of those reasons are instrumental reasons, which, you know, have their own validity. But for me, I think I'm one of those kind of fantasist people, and I really believe in the power of exploration.
Oh boy.
To go boldly where no one has ever gone before.
I love that whole Star Trek thing.
I think there's some real value to going into the unknown, being unsure of what the discovery will yield to you. Because what Chris has done is sort of illuminating side effects of an exploration, because that's not exactly what they expected to get out of it, right? They were trying to land on the moon. That was the explicit job. Mm-hmm. But the gains are all these other things that we now feel are essential to our lives, which, by the way, a big piece of that is also GPS technology.
Oh, honey.
We'd all probably drive into the ocean. But if you think
I would have to find my way out of this room right now, if it wasn't for Apollo, whatever.
But I also think about the fact that, guess what? Earth is a planet, and every time we explore, we recognize ourselves in the universe, because we're part of the universe. Mm-hmm. So any knowledge we gain is also knowledge we gain of ourselves, and so it's both materially important, but also psychically important. Because if you think about what we were able to do when we thought the world was flat, and then we figured out that it wasn't, I just think that I can't imagine what we might discover if we are trying to land on Mars and we suddenly realize that, guess what, the sun is not the center of us all.
Holy shit.
How mind-blown will that be?
You blew my mind right now.
Can I continue to play devil's advocate for a moment?
Yeah, sure.
I mean, if you must.
You've both made great points.
Oh, we know.
And I'm just praising you two up and down. No. Some of which I hadn't thought about before. But I guess that leads me to this, though. I mean, technological advances, mm-hmm. some technological advances, are a mixed bag.
Yeah.
Some of them, so I guess the question becomes, the things that you both are rightly saying, you know, we have gained through space exploration, landing on the moon, that kind of thing, have those things contributed to a more, you know, peaceful humanity, a more equitable humanity. Here no, wait, let me finish. Let me finish.
No. So, I get your point, though. Keep going.
Let me just finish. So the last point you just made, Tricia, which I really like about us understanding, you know, our part in the universe and we are part of one universe, I love that point. What's interesting to me, though, is, and I don't know, like, I haven't studied this, I don't know if there's data about this, but what's amazing to me, I mean, if we look at, like, a lot of, like, Trump supporters right now, is, like, this illusion that, like, there are these, you know, races or different groups of people that are inherently different and aren't part of one whole, like, people who don't, or, you know, are not concerned about climate change, don't recognize that we're, like, part of one planet. Like, I'm just wondering, like, has that led to a consciousness that's actually been helpful in terms of us being more, you know,
I think you're right. I think you're right, Jason. I think it leads to the initial point that Chris made, which is that it's our dialogue. Our dialogue does not allow us to move beyond and decenter ourselves. You know, I mean, I think you're right. I mean, I think lots of the things that have come out of our learning should have shifted our thinking.
And it but has.
It has for some.
Pretending like scientific exploration should or does have some moral vector.
Oh, no. I mean, it has nothing.
That's what Jason is suggesting.
Well, listen. But listen. Jason is right to ask if we should spend billions of dollars mm-hmm. if we can't see explicit gains in some of the more compelling problems of our age, which is ignorance, racism. I mean, all of the major challenging issues should have been informed by our exploration.
Starvation, climate change, melting polar ice caps. I mean, those things will affect us. That will certainly wipe us out faster than racism will. And the idea that space exploration could help with some of those things, I mean... Okay, let me just back off a little bit.
Yes. So,
let me back off a
You're
little
getting
bit.
All angry.
I'm getting very angry. I'm You're still angry with that fucking Lena Dunham thing.
You are pissed.
Lena Dunham, I can't stand you. Are you listening? Is she here?
Why don't we take those $2 billion and strap all the white feminists into chairs and give them 3 days of race equity training? Wouldn't that be a better use of the money?
Send them to Mars.
No.
It'll be a sequel to the Matt Damon movie. Bring them home.
Nobody should stop bringing Matt Damon home from anything.
Okay, so I just want to, I'm not going to walk back my statements, but I am going to calm down a bit.
Yeah, that would be appreciated.
Trisha's very scared. She's like, I don't like the same person format. Can I go back to LA?
Trisha has never been scared of me.
I'm looking at you like, what?
I know, she's looking at me right now.
I'm like, listen, I just want us to keep getting some interesting points in. So move past this bullshit.
The a priori decision about, like, oh, should we explore this? Is this going to fix the problems that we identify as problems today? I just don't see any value in having that conversation.
Why?
Because stepping forward is always better than standing still. Always. And stepping forward is going to lead you somewhere new, and there'll be new challenges. There'll be pros and cons, right? But then you balance them. You balance those things in the moment like we balance those things today.
Wait a minute. Who's this person talking?
That's a smart person, according to
Jason. I mean,
I can't stop saying smart things today.
I mean, wait a minute. Who is this exploratory, adventurous idea that
What's
you
happening?
Are describing?
I know what. Shut up.
This is a whole new trend.
This has nothing to do with my personal life. Okay? We're having a conversation.
No, not even personal. Space. Because this is not. This has not traditionally been even your approach with ideas.
No, you're right. You're right.
You know?
Listen.
And so tell me, when you have previously been reticent about even being adventurous with ideas, why you suddenly are challenging Jason?
Okay, if this is about the way I tear Jason's ideas down
episode to episode,
because his ideas are ridiculous.
No. I'm talking specifically. No, because actually, I think in a really, really concrete way, Jason has raised an issue that I think challenges how we have traditionally approached our conversation on a meta level, right? Which is that Jason is sort of asking a kind of, why are we doing this fanciful thing when there are some real hard and fast practical problems that could seriously use $2 billion?
Yeah.
And now you are coming back defending a quote-unquote fanciful exploration.
Because usually Jason's the fanciful one. And I'm like, Jason, cut that shit out.
I'm thinking about what you just said about, you know, we could discover things that help us solve climate change. That makes sense, except it seems to me that the reason it's not, I mean, not to say we wouldn't benefit from more scientific knowledge, but we have plenty of knowledge of things we could be doing. It's the politics and the alienation. It's a human problem.
Yep.
And then, like, to think that, like, more knowledge is going to suddenly make the crazy motherfuckers running this country or getting in the way of running this country, that they're suddenly going to become receptive to these ideas. I don't know. So I'll shut up.
You actually make a really good point. Because for a really long time, we as a society have really engaged in, there's a specific term for it. We talked about it when I was in graduate school. And it's like this technology of hope ideology. It's this notion that these sort of hard and fast discoveries will ameliorate problems. When the reality is that a lot of our problems are kind of man-made,
yes,
and then are built around willful ignorance. So it's like we do know scientifically that climate change is happening, except our policies are not in line with that.
Yes.
So what's the value of attempting to get more concrete knowledge when we are not actually and practically utilizing them, aside from the fact that now I can find Pokemon on my phone.
Hello.
But you know what I mean? Like, that's what usually happens. What usually happens is that you will take something that is, you're right, that could truly transform our lives. Uh-huh. But because we focus on sort of the most petty and kind of the silliest version of it, that's what we connect to.
Okay.
Yes.
And then we resist.
Take that, Chris. What are you going to say? And what, Chris?
You guys are separating this out in a way that I think is just so simplistic and doesn't actually take the context of the human experience, right?
What is that? Actually, I think we're being very conscious of humans.
No, I think you guys are separating out like this idea of like what's man-made versus what is concrete and scientific, and I think those things come together. Case in point, you mentioned world being flat before.
Yes.
There was a moment in time when people believed the world was flat.
Yes.
Then several scholars were like, actually, it's not flat, it's round. Those people were roundly decried and then rounded up and taken care of, right? There was a point in time where the evidence about the round earth was so overwhelming that if you continue to ignore it, you would suffer in ways that are both social and economic. The idea that you could roll around the earth the other way made sense. People did it, saved money, were able to colonize and get more goods. There was a point at which the scientific
evidence... That's what they were able to do. Did you hear what you just said?
They were able to colonize and get more goods.
No, hallelujah! That's been great for the
That's
world. You know what? We'd be better off if they thought it was flat.
No, see, because now you are joining the climate deniers. Because the idea is my point is that scientific discovery reached such a point that you could no longer deny it. It is just, it was clear as day. And then, yes, there were pros and there were cons. But the idea is then we were then dealing with the world the way that it was, and we had more information on which to arm ourselves. Now, you both have mentioned willful ignorance, but it seems to me that that's sort of what you're appealing
to.
No,
we're not. We're
right?
Not.
So the idea that, well, explain this to me, because this is what I'm hearing. What I'm hearing is that if we cannot a priori decide that this scientific exploration is going to cure the man, quote-unquote, man-made ills of the day, then perhaps we should think about rerouting that money into something that we know will fix the man-made problems.
It has nothing to do with knowledge.
Let me just finish that, and then we'll hear from both of you. So to me, that sounds like willful ignorance, and the idea, like, let's only use the information we have in the room today, and although there might be information right outside that door, not interested, because there's so much to deal with in here.
What I'm saying is that you are assuming that knowledge and the pursuit of knowledge does not have a social context. And so even when you were making your point about the fact that at some point in time, the discoveries of science necessarily became something that we had to take seriously because mm-hmm. it was just true,
mm-hmm.
None of us denies that. But what I'm trying to say is that the willful pursuit of knowledge without a kind of social reckoning is just careless and dangerous. Because listen, because you could have chosen not to colonize. There's a you could pursue without colonization. Colonization has been woeful to people. I know that people.
Are you drawing a direct one to one?
I'm not drawing a direct one
to colonization.
No. But I'm just saying. But you did. And what we're trying to say is that we need some sort of mediating factor when we make these decisions. We're taking $2 million for $1 billion for the pursuit of this knowledge, which I love. I think the pursuit of knowledge is just enlivening.
Noble.
I think and noble, and I think all of those things. However, we do not do things out of a kind of purity in that way, and that there are choices to be made because money is a limited resource.
Of course.
And sometimes we have to push back on this. We have to say, why spend $2 billion when you can spend $1 billion? I mean, the one thing is, why can't we work on our educational problem? It's a real problem. It actually has concrete, solvable things.
Why can't we work on two things at once?
Because we can, but why do we have to spend $2 billion doing it? Why? Because money is not floating out of the sky like that. So we have
How
to
do
make
we know?
Choices.
No, let's go to the sky and find
no,
out.
There's no money floating. See, no, it's not. No. Money
there's a money
flow.
Cloud that orbits Jupiter, and the only That's, way for us to find it.
You know what's funny? We're joking. You honestly fucking don't know. You don't know if that's somewhere on the outskirts of Uranus. I heard it.
Yes.
You don't know if on the outskirts of Uranus there's not some asteroid that's full of some mineral that's going to give us renewable energy forever, solving a multitude of problems and creating some new ones. You don't know.
All right, but you know what? Okay. I already know what the existing problems are
now. We come back to this
and I'm
idea.
Not. I'm not aware of the. I'm not aware of the existing solution. However, I am aware that this $2 billion is the pursuit of a problem that isn't really a problem.
You don't know what. Problems. This so, is.
I'm fine, but I know it's not going to solve our education problem.
All right. Well, Carla, you're on with Trisha.
Thank you for having me on. I listen to the show every other week. You guys are great.
Jason, I'm defending your point.
I appreciate it, and you're doing it very vigorously. I appreciate it. I mean, what you said, Chris, I agree. It should not be either or. It should be both and. And this is not just about, you know, space exploration and what we're spending on that. But the thing is, everything we've been talking about, any knowledge, like, so we, I think all three of us would agree, like, perception is reality. I'll rescind that. It doesn't really matter. The point is that the challenge, every time we make a scientific discovery, going all the way back to the things you've said hundreds of years ago to today, is it gets filtered through all of our human limitations, misperceptions. So if there is racism or unconscious bias, which of course we know there is, then technological advancements get filtered through that. And so, yep. You know, many cases, a technological innovation at first, it's interesting, I hadn't heard that term before, Trisha, about the ideology of like, hope and technology. But yeah, we have this idea that, oh, you know, there's this new technology and that's going to help everyone, and of course it gets distributed in the same inequitable ways, and not only that, but again, to the point of like colonization, it gets utilized for bad means, like, you know, atomic bomb, like things like that. So I am not saying I think we should, you know, cut NASA and we shouldn't be exploring space. We as a society, in terms of how we invest our resources and how we prioritize, there's like no investment right now in us as a society reckoning with, acknowledging truth and reconciliation, becoming conscious of our unconscious biases. I mean, if we were to map resources, which is something you can certainly do, we're putting like almost no resources into that. We're putting lots of resources into lots of other things. If we don't invest time and money dealing with our misperception problems, our ignorance problems, our unconscious biases, then we can expect that all of these scientific advancements will continue to be filtered through all of our limitations and our misperceptions and just continue to perpetuate inequity and oppression.
Yes. That is the point. Because what happens is you essentially use your knowledge to subjugate and recreate the world that you have. Yes, well there'll said. Be some changes, well and
you,
yes, there'll be some improvements.
You don't think you guys are like running with the spot
no,
right now?
No, you know why? Guess what? Even though we now can perform surgeries yes. on people because of the knowledge, how does that get played out in the real world?
Okay.
That's what. So what we're saying is it's not that there is an either or. It's just that we have to be working towards an end that is about a reckoning of our humanity, and we don't do that. We don't use right. that knowledge. We actually do use that knowledge to kind of buttress our ignorance and buttress inequality. And that's what I mean. That has been the technology of hope. People thought, well, now that everyone in the world has access to a computer, magically kids will learn. And what are we finding? We're finding increasing inequality. So it's not to say that we don't pursue knowledge.
What's the action item then?
Well, the action item, Christopher, yes. because we don't always have to have 1, 2, 3, because this was the point you were making.
Well, first of all, you guys are introducing the fact that we have to select some problems over others before we can deal with anything else.
No.
So what's the
no,
action?
No, that's
you
know, not true.
No, I know. I'm sounding a straw man. What do you say? So
you know
I,
what, my,
listen,
you know
wait,
what?
Wait, let me just say this.
Let's deal
I
with
understand
the education
what you guys are
thing.
Saying. I know what you guys are saying, right?
You do.
And I get it, but I just don't understand where you go from that. So, yes.
We go from the point.
Because our society, let's talk about America. Well, let's talk about the world, actually. It's a global problem. Because we have inequitable access to resources, new resources mm-hmm. are going to be inequitably distributed.
Yes.
Right? Whatever that resource is. So if we get that, you know, renewable energy resource from the edge of Uranus, then it's going to be inequitably distributed.
Yeah.
So I hear what you're saying. But then after listening to you guys, I'm saying, so we shouldn't actually obtain that mythical
no.
renewable sources.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Pour it into,
that's
we
not
should
what
fix
I'm
our inequity problems first.
No.
No.
Okay, no.
So
it's not a first.
Help me get to where
it's
you are.
It's not a first. First and foremost, we have to recognize the limitations of certain resources, which is cash.
Okay.
Cash is a limited
yeah.
resource. So I understand that $2 billion means we might acquire knowledge in 20 years.
Mm-hmm.
But I say use 1 billion, and yes, it might take longer, but at least distribute that $1 billion into actively attempting to fix the education problem so that whenever we discover what we're going to discover, we're going to understand it better. We're going to actually use it to, we might be able to use it to make our lives better. But it's like, to my mind, it's just willfully move towards this space and say, okay, we just gotta have to go pursue knowledge. Meanwhile, you got people starving. It just feels like a waste to me. We have to recognize limits, and we also have to recognize that there are no boundaries. The same as you want me to understand that the universe is boundaryless mm-hmm. and we need to keep going, we also have to also look on the other side and say, you know what? We do have some limited resources. We don't have enough money to keep just willfully going in this direction. Because one of the things is, you know what? They have wasted a lot of money at NASA. They have. And because it's because
the
it's
word
so
waste.
They but
this
they
comes back to my original point.
No,
it's
but
like
they
you
them,
actually don't know what they're doing with
no,
it.
No, no, no. Because they themselves admitted that. They have made poor choices. They have pursued things that early on they knew wasn't yielding what they wanted, and they couldn't pull back on it because it's just also the way that money is distributed.
That's scientific investment.
But no, it has nothing to do with that. That's a political piece. For them, they were like, you know what? If we pull back from this initiative, people will say that we're wasting their time and money, and so we have to just keep going, even though we're nowhere off, because it's like when you have $500 and you got to use it all, or the government will give you $250 right. next time. Mm-hmm. So it's those kinds of kind of thoughtful, metered out discussion mm-hmm. rather than just saying, yes, we're going to go do this thing and it's $2 billion. We should be like asking ourselves, what are our resources? Where can some of it be better spent? And don't punish NASA if they make a mistake about something. I mean, it's just, there should be fuller discussions about it.
Okay.
It's complicated,
Jason,
Christopher.
Yes,
we have to move on from this, but you should have the last word. What do you think about this whole discussion? Did you learn anything? What are you doing over there? What did you do with all your free time while me and Trish were screaming into the microphone?
Yeah. I wasn't listening. What were you guys talking about? No, this has been helpful because I think prior to the conversation, I was thinking in an either-or way. And I think I am now thinking in a both-and way. And I think I agree. I hate to say it. Chris is going to get annoyed, but I agree with Trisha that, like...
Of course you do.
No, I think it's right, though, in terms of... I think that we should continue to pursue the, you know, space exploration, the acquisition of knowledge, but we should be willing to set different timelines, and it is not, that's not the only place we should be taking money from. There's plenty of other places we could be taking money from. But we need to be, at some point we need to invest in, yes, improving education, yes, making sure race equity and a history of oppression are things that we teach in schools, and not just in schools to kids, but like we need to be creating ways that adults are learning about these things. So, yes, the conversation has pushed my thinking a lot.
I want to say that I don't disagree with Trisha. I understand where you're coming from, Trish. Like, I totally get it. I totally understand what you're saying. I think what I was taking away was that and this is what you're saying, we should put the brakes on some of this stuff to refocus. And I need to think about that. But I think my initial point to Jason's initial question was that we... Like, Jason, you came to the conversation without educating yourself about the no less than 6 devices you're using at this second that were brought to you by space exploration. And I think that is part of the bigger problem that we're having when it comes to scientific endeavors.
We're
like, oh, microwave ovens, you know, flat screen curved TVs. Oh, these are great. I guess these just came out of nowhere. Like that. That is a big education problem we have in this. And this is alongside the point that you two are making. But if we actually in schools talked about how we get these technologies and sort of like the modes of thought that brought us here, perhaps we could weigh scientific exploration the way that you and Trisha are suggesting. So there it is.
Thank you.
Sure.
Fascinating.
So last but not least, Trisha has a very light topic. Something a little fluffy for us to discuss.
I thought mine was pretty fluffy, and it ended up being a friggin' war. But anyway, this is gonna get real interesting.
War of the Worlds.
Yes. Yeah. Literally.
I believe it was several weeks ago. A quarterback for a football team. His name is Colin
Kaepernick.
Kaepernick.
Which is just a fun name to say.
Colin Kaepernick.
Is cute. I think we should first start off by saying
he's very attractive. And he has
all the three of us were thinking
and
about,
he
right,
has
Jay?
A big old afro now, which we all love.
Yeah.
But Colin Kaepernick essentially decided that he was going to be taking a knee during the national anthem because he did not want to support a symbol of a country that continues to suppress and endanger the lives of its citizens, mm-hmm. most explicitly its African American citizens. And people proceeded to lose their minds. And out of this act, I think several elements have emerged as places to sort of challenge his right to protest. First, I think there's the general question of how are we supposed to treat symbols of a country with a complicated history. That's one tact of it. Both the flag, which now for some reason is a shorthand for the military in some way. So if you don't respect the flag, ergo you don't respect the military. So that's one aspect. The other is explicitly the national anthem, which now some people I think have discovered that the third stanza is bit dodgy. We don't generally sing about it. And then there's also this other piece about him being too wealthy or too privileged to take such a stance for poor people or African Americans, of which he is one. And then just a general question about patriotism. So I wanted to know whether any of these are sort of viable arguments. And then I wanted to explore the role of sort of athletes in general in asking or challenging the society. What's, do they have a special responsibility? Is this ridiculous? Like, what should we be thinking about this?
I'm so frustrated by so much of it that I
it is, right?
I hesitate to comment because I feel like I'm going to get irrational and annoying.
I did that last segment, so go ahead.
Okay, thank you.
Please do.
First of all, if we love this country so much, one of the things that, you know, this country is supposedly built on is free expression of ideas and just, like, freedom. And anyone should be able to fucking sit or stand during the national anthem. Like, it should not – just – it's crazy to me that people have such a strong reaction to that. That's one. Two, you two know how I feel about professional sports, particularly professional football. And the answer to your question is, Tricia, do athletes have, like, some special responsibility? Well, they do because we give it to them. I don't understand why. I mean, I listened – there was this – I don't know if you two heard it. I listened on NPR. They ran a segment. It was produced by a 15-year-old African-American boy. So well done. He said he was 15 towards the end. I was sure he was like in his early 20s. It was so well done. And he was interviewing classmates, both white and black and other races, about their views on this. It was so interesting. But like one girl who happened to be African-American was like, you know, I think we could have – and she, again, this is a teenager. She's like 15. She's like, I think we could have a debate about like the national anthem and whether you sit or stand. But are we – I don't understand why we're arguing about this at a football game. She said, and I thought this was a great point, why is it that we only play the national anthem at sports games? Like, how important is this song to us really? Yeah. You don't hear it all the time. We play it at sports games. And so that's where this is getting litigated. It's like so insane to me after reading that third – verse, which I had not read before, I'm like, yeah, this should not be our national anthem anymore. Like, we should change it. And I don't think that's unpatriotic. Like, we just should change it. So I just, there's so much of this debate that bothers me. I'm just very frustrated.
Jason, so something you said earlier on in that was that, you know, the country is based on the idea of freedom. Is it? Because, no, it's not. And, okay. The country is not based on the idea of freedom. It's based on the idea of extremely wealthy people not having to pay other extremely wealthy people. That's the freedom to not pay, to make as much money as you can off of the land and resources that you own. That's what the country is actually based on. Everything else is fluffy. The idea of it's funny when you look it up, like, the founding fathers wrote freedom of the press and then immediately began suppressing stories that were negative about them. Like, you know, it was all fluff. This country is based on the idea of getting as much wealth and power as possible and consolidating it in the hands of a few. In that way, what really galls me about this, and as you both know, I enjoy my racists where I can see them. What really galls me about this is the fact that people don't really recognize what the flag stands for and what the anthem is about and what the country's about. The fact that Colin Kaepernick does not want to stand for the national anthem makes complete sense to me. He's a black person, right? And this country was founded on the blood of his ancestors. The idea that people kind of don't get that, and the idea that they would force him to stand or want to boycott the team, just it's just really sort of like the old world, like, get the Negroes in line sort of behavior that you saw around slavery. Like, why would you expect him to stand and worship this country? Now everyone's like, oh, but he's exactly like Tricia brought up. Oh, he's a rich man and this country's been so good to him. Yes, until he gets stopped for a parking ticket and then he has to fear for his life. And that's not a trade-off that other white football players are making. So it's not even like, well, yes, those problems exist and he's very rich, you know, but so are plenty of white, so is Conan O'Brien. Conan O'Brien is very rich and he's white, but the trade-off for his riches wasn't being constant fear for his life. So the fact that Colin Kaepernick is not enthusiastic about this country and what that flag and that symbol stands for makes complete sense. And anyone who says otherwise is being willfully ignorant of the history.
I mean, I think we've been having this theme throughout our podcast all year, actually, which is, what do we do with the history of our institutions and some of its symbols. And the explicit history, the explicit symbol here is the national anthem, right? Which then actually calls to a moment in our history that we haven't taken the time to really remember or even honor. Because this feels very similar to what happened to the Georgetown incident, and it also feels really similar to what happened with the Princeton incident, right? It's like we have these historical moments of truth, and then in the present, we want to pretend that we don't know about it, we should ignore it. Like, how? I feel like that's also part of the question. Like, how do we handle the weight of our history?
Head on. I think we should handle it head on.
But the national anthem is a specific one, right? Okay. Because if it comes up often, not often, but if it comes up at sporting events and people want to have a conversation about how we interact with it,
yeah,
we're always going to be dealing with it. Many sporting events happen, right? Mm-hmm. We're not always going to be dealing with the Princeton issue. We're not always going to be dealing with the issue that happened at Georgetown University, right? Mm-hmm. But this is something that's in our daily lives.
Yeah.
So in some weird way, it's almost like I kind of want people to sort of really listen to the anthem and sort of stand with it and sort of live with the truth of it, which is that there, everything that you just said in our previous segment, Chris, that there were costs to where you land today.
Mm-hmm.
And that the cost of that is that your country came out of blood and suffering of its people, mm-hmm. of its slaves. Mm-hmm. But it's like we can't ever come to terms with that. We have to kind of pretend. Like, how can you deny what Colin Kaepernick said? Like, that's the history. But right. I felt like it was the same conversation we were having with that guy who wrote the article about In Defense of White Men. Remember that article where he was like, now yeah. we have a history that says that the country was founded on subjugation. It was!
Yeah, right. Yeah, no. I would love to see a significant number of white players sit for the anthem. And yeah. I actually think, unfortunately, that's probably the most likely path to a real conversation about this. It seems to me, I mean, you got a lot of white players in the NFL. I feel like we should be able to find, 10 to 20 that'd be willing to sit during the anthem.
Can I take a sharp left?
Mm-hmm.
So in thinking about this and the idea of the history of the country and the founding of the country, of which I'm always slamming back and educating people on, it raises the question, like, how do we, it's the same question you asked, Tricia, but I'm just thinking about this in practical terms now. How do we move forward? Like, let's all get around a table, look each other in the eye, admit what this country has done to people, and then we move forward. Like, how do we get to a point where we can stand for the national anthem? How do we get to a point where we can all look at the flag and feel proud? Like, do we have to throw all of these symbols out and start again?
No.
So where do we go?
What we have to do is we have to be truthful. This is the thing I can't take. And maybe this is part of like the anti-intellectual piece that's happened in this country and the anti-science piece. But why can't we admit to the truth of what studies show?
In what way?
Which is that black people are differently impacted by the criminal justice system. And then we should move towards ameliorating that. Why must we deny the truth of what findings suggest?
Okay, so that...
Well, yeah, there's an answer to your question.
Mm-hmm.
The answer to your question, there's a two-part answer. One is that in order for us to do that, that would require, first of all, it runs counter to the narrative in our country that everyone's a victim, including white people, right? Wealthy people are victims of overtaxation. Wealthy companies are victims of overregulation. Like, everyone's a victim. So that's one reason why we can't, is because everyone's constantly telling themselves that they're a victim. And that it, I don't know that there's room in people's heads for that I'm actually benefiting from something. And that ties to the second reason, which is, well, for me to acknowledge what you said, Tricia, for me as a white man to acknowledge that, I then have to acknowledge that I may have some unconscious bias. I may have some racial tendencies. I am benefiting from racist oppression. And who wants to do that?
See, I think about systems, and I think about institutions, and I really think about the way Obama talks about those, because our institutions are never perfect. Mm-hmm. The idea is that we are always moving towards perfection. We are moving towards making things better. And so in order for us to move towards making something better, we have to admit the flaws. But now we can't even open up a space for conversation, because in some ways that's what Colin Kaepernick wanted. He said, I want us to have a conversation. Yeah, yeah. I want us to begin. If every time I take a knee, it's an explicit moment for you to reflect on why I'm taking a knee. Mm-hmm. And so this sort of comes back to my initial question, is what's the value of an athlete doing it? Because our preoccupation is on sport, and we gather around our TV as a community to watch sport, I do find it very meaningful, because there's so many places where we are split off and we'll be watching something else and doing our own thing, right? Mm-hmm. But sports continues, and live events continues to be a sort of unifying space, mm-hmm, where more people than not watch. So maybe it's not sports for you, Jason, but it might be like a news conference or a live musical event or something. So whenever we can find ourselves in spaces where we feel like a crowd of people are watching, I think it's useful for somebody who has some sort of movement in that space to take a moment to cause us to reflect on the challenges that other people are facing. So I think that's what's important about having an athlete speak. But it's just, I can't deal with, you know what, I guess I come right back to the explicit piece, which was something we tackled very, very early on in our discussion many, many moons ago, which is the reparations discussion. I think if we can have an explicit conversation about reparations, which was not about actual reparations or cash or anything, but it was actually a real study, an explicit study about how our institutions are informed or were informed by slavery, I think we can't move on, because every time we come up here, we always have to stop.
I've been thinking that Colin Kaepernick has been protesting against the country's history, but he's protesting against the country's present day behavior. And and I think, you know, I often protest the nation's history, because I think it's an appalling, and it's appalling the way this country came to be. But I think really my issue with it is really the present day stuff, and the idea that we continue to deny that that history even happened, you know. Sidebar, Bill O'Reilly going on TV to remind his listeners that after a certain period, Washington, D.C., the government stopped hiring slaves. And I was like, bitch, nobody hires slaves, okay? So I don't know what this broadcast is about. But, you know, the idea that we refuse to believe that things are the way they are in this country is a problem. Now, before we get to reparations, you know, my question that I asked when I took the hard left was that, okay, so let's say I'm gonna be Jason. Everyone on Earth is gonna get around a table, and we're going to acknowledge that this has happened, right? Then is our next step fixing? Like, okay, so the president, whoever it is, Clinton, Trump, you know, a bag of bananas, the way this election's going, there's no way to tell, stands up and says, you know, we recognize as American people, the government recognizes the country was built, blah, 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 and that we have these inequities, da, da, da. What's next? How do we start feeling good about America then?
You know what? You start feeling good about America when you start working on issues. Because listen, if we're in a relationship, mm-hmm, and I sit down with you and you acknowledge that you have been abusive to me, mm-hmm, first thing that happens to me is that I feel heard. And because you are acknowledging that you've abused me,
your experience is real. Not that it wasn't real before, but it's real in the space.
It's real now because it's a shared, mm-hmm, we don't share the history and a context. That's the Colin Kaepernick. That's why we've had these diverging responses to him. Mm-hmm. Because we don't share the truth of what he's admitting. Mm-hmm. So if we can even just acknowledge the truth of what even police data shows, it's not even anti-police, because that's also been reared. Like, that's the other thing. This is anti-police. How can it be anti-police when even the police data says that black people are disproportionately poorly affected? Mm-hmm. Fine. Then, okay, he's not anti veterans, because guess what? He's asking us to treat veterans better when they come home. Mm-hmm. And explicitly our numbers say it, because we talked about mental health issues a few weeks ago, and we know we're not taking care of veterans. So that's why I feel like the noise around his around him has completely prevented us from seeing the truth of what he's asking us. He's simply saying, how can we fully embrace the country and its symbols when we're not actively working to perfect the very things that the symbol says we have? Mm-hmm. Our institutions need to be moving towards that. And so for me, I think that's what happens. When you have a reconciliation conversation, as Jason said and suggested in the previous conversation, you can then acknowledge that we're basically all working under the same sky. And then we can say, okay, then how can we fix our criminal justice system? And then we can move towards that. But if we can't even admit that certain things are broken, how are we...
I don't know how we're going to get here.
We can't get here because we keep getting caught up in our symbols. He's just saying, it's like if you were waving a flag and said your relationship was perfect. Our relationship is perfect, mm-hmm. and you're abusing me. Mm-hmm. How can we work on it?
No,
it's impossible. And it's not to say that you take it away, mm-hmm. but you simply say, you know what, we are honoring this, but we have to still move towards it. We're not there yet.
Meanwhile, America's talks out of both sides of their mouth.
What do you think, Jason?
Yeah, what do you think, Jason?
Well, I've really fallen in love with my idea to recruit. I'd like to, at this point, speak directly to all of our listeners who are white NFL players and ask you to please sit for the national anthem, because that will change the trajectory of the conversation. It won't be another black athlete making a problem, but a group of athletes of different races who want to have a real conversation, want to spark a real conversation about issues in this country. And then once, as you're saying, Trisha, we can have a shared understanding of some of the problems, then we can work together towards solutions, work towards better policy, that kind of thing. That's what I think.
Well, you know, the question, this is an aside, and I guess it's related. I mean, you work in social, you all work with in these communities in some ways. How do we develop a shared understanding?
Oh, God, come on.
But that's the thing. Like if you and I are in a relationship and you were abusing me, how do I let you know you're abusing me?
There's an answer to that. Mm-hmm. And the answer is, we have to think through, how is it in people's interest to come to the table and see this, or how can it be made in their interest?
So I kind of blackmail you into it?
I mean, you could say it that way, but that's how stuff gets done all the time.
Yes, you can say it that way, because that's what it is.
Gets done all the time. Like, that's how you get institutions to change. I mean, I see it all the time in the philanthropic world and in federal grants. I mean, the Obama administration has done this a ton in different areas, education and others.
Let's not spin too far off this topic, though, because Trisha's question was, how do we get to be on the same page on the issues that Kaepernick is trying to spark conversation about?
Okay, my answer is, you make it in people's interest to do so, which is possible.
How is it in the country's best interest to acknowledge its history and the legacy of white supremacy?
Well, the answer to that from like a macro point of view is, one, there are plenty of studies that have shown that our achievement and opportunity gaps along racial lines, actually, like, we could have a higher GDP if we were educating more equitably and if there was more equitable opportunity to the workforce. The fact that we have whole communities of people that end up on welfare and in prison and all of that, like, that has a cost, like a real economic cost. So that's one way that it's in our interest. Well, I'll stop there.
Oh, how could I have missed this?
I don't know. Fix all our problems.
No, how could I have missed it? Self-interest.
How could you miss it? We've been talking about it for 5 minutes.
How could I have missed it? See, my thing is, the reason why I've been blocked, oh my God, let me just be really explicit about this. The reason why I've really been blocked with this issue is because I want people to acknowledge the truth of a thing, which is so ignorant of me. In other spaces, you can say, I'm going to abandon this, right? In a normal clinical relationship, if you're going to have it, you would say, you have to abandon this space. It's not working out. But we're forced to live together. And so we can't abandon relationships or we can't abandon spaces that appear abusive. We have to kind of pull them apart and say, okay, how do we work towards making them more just? But I'm going to have to appeal not to your quote-unquote goodness. I'm going to have to appeal to your self-interest, which is that if we continue to put everyone in jail, eventually your child will not have the things you need, your legacy, your kids, your whatever. So I'm going to have to appeal to your self-interest to make sure that we work towards the greater good. We've had a really difficult time suggesting to people that we're going to live together or die apart because people believe that they will be able to be okay.
Oh.
People believe that left to their own devices, Beverly Hills will be fine if South Central falls off the pit.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And have to be able to suggest that Beverly Hills will really not be fine ultimately.
Mm-hmm. Like the Koch brothers. Most of their views, you know, I find totally heinous and bad for the country. That said, they see it as in their self-interest and is in the self-interest of the country to drastically reduce incarceration rates because they think the economy is better without a lot of taxes, and the more people incarcerated, the more we pay in taxes. So they actually, like one of maybe the only area in which, like, I may agree with anything they believe is, like, we need to reduce mass incarceration. I think finding unlikely bedfellows like that where they already see it in their interest to do something, it's joining with folks like that and then figuring out, like, okay, where can we – maybe we can agree. Maybe I can convince you that, like, what we're talking about, like, dealing with and educating people about the history of racism – can help us ultimately reduce incarceration rates. Maybe not. Maybe we have to go a step, you know, before that. Like, maybe it's about, well, we know it is, you know, black people are disproportionately incarcerated. Like, you have to find where you can meet in the middle. But, I mean, I think that's right. I think you have to figure out what's in people's self-interest and how this
appeals. Jason, I see your point about how you can traditionally get people around the table, even if their motives are different. While I wonder if we'll actually get the change we want, I think we might be able to get the outcomes we want, even if we don't end up changing people's hearts and minds. So just like you've just used the, is it the Koch? I never know how to pronounce that.
I think it's
the Koch brothers? The Koch brothers?
The Koch brothers is a different kind of video altogether.
Even if they're doing it because of taxes and we're doing it because we don't like black people in jail, we might have to work on that together.
Yeah.
And I think that's been really where the rub has been, is that we have to kind of convince different groups of people that it's important for Mexican Americans or Latinos to find a path to citizenship, not so much because we want to move away from punitive policies, but it's in our best interest as a country to have everyone fully accessing all the resources and then giving back to the country as best as possible so we can get these people's taxes. You know what I mean? Like,
right.
We have to make those kinds of claims.
Let's move on from here to media recommendations, which is something that you've seen, heard, or read you think other people should see, hear, or read. And let's go with Trisha.
Now, this is something that is an experience that I want people to have: live theater. I've been in New York, and I've missed it. I didn't realize I miss it. And I didn't realize there's something really valuable about watching people perform on stage. Mm-hmm. So I saw this wonderful play called The Humans. And if you ever make your way to New York, I would highly recommend it.
You better hurry. It's closing.
It's probably closing, but I'm hoping it will make it some rounds. But even if you don't, might I suggest that you sort of check out any local theater in your neck of the woods that has a play that is just about people. It's really fascinating to just sort of inhabit that space and watch. Because you know what? That's exactly what we're talking about. I was watching, and it was, I think it was an Irish Catholic family, get together for Thanksgiving. That's really what the play is about. Mm-hmm. And just the nuances of those interactions, the painful moments, the great moments. I mean, it was just, it was a joy. I left the theater completely enlivened by watching this.
And it makes people's experience more immediate to the viewer. It tells you a story. Like this last week, I saw Fiddler on the Roof for the first time. And I know, Trish, you went to go see The Color Purple again. And as a friend said last night, the idea that theater is using, is telling these tribe stories and getting it across in a way that a class never could. So like watching Fiddler on the Roof and the struggle between tradition and modernism in this like traditional Jewish village. Like the, if people in the theater were discussing Judaism in a way by viewing this play, like discussing the culture of it. And it's really super powerful, and it sort of bleeds back on the topics that we're talking about today. It gives you an opportunity to identify and be like, oh. Also the fact that I love that that play you saw is just called The Humans.
Yeah, I love that.
And even before we were started the broadcast, you weren't clear if they were Irish Catholic or Jewish. Like, it, no, it was called The Humans, which, again, is always my thing. Like, we're all human, and although we're all different, sometimes we don't even appreciate that bare fact that we're all same on some level. Anyway, cool. Great recommendation. What about you, Jason? What are you going to say?
Friday night, I saw Ghostbusters.
Yes! What did you think?
I really liked it. Mm-hmm. Really, really liked it. And not only did I really like it, and I for so many reasons, I thought it was very funny and very well done. I love that almost everyone from the first one appeared in it. I just love that. But while I was at the movie theater, I saw a poster for Tom Cruise in the second Jack Reacher movie. So I'm excited about that because I've been reading all the Jack Reacher books. So I just wanted to mention that. That's coming out in October. And then there was a coming attraction for Inferno, the Dan Brown novel.
I really enjoyed
that novel. And even though I think the first movie based on a Dan Brown book, Da Vinci Code, I thought was a terrible movie, I really liked Angels and Demons, the second one, and now I'm very excited to see this third one.
I didn't know you were such a big fan of Airport Lit.
I know.
I'm not all Airport Lit, but there's certain ones I get stuck on. And I've read all the Dan Brown books. There's actually, I'll just mention very quickly, there's a Dan Brown book about NASA and about NASA faking.
Well, read it, please, and understand what NASA does for you.
No, I've read it. No, it doesn't. I don't think it does a good job. It's not on your side. So Ghostbusters, go see it and get excited about these other movies coming out.
I wanted to call out a particular article that was in the Washington Post by the time you hear this a couple of weeks ago called It's Time to Stop Talking About Racism with White People by Zach Lindley. And I've seen this article, this idea has proliferated around the internet for a while now, and the idea that the path to black liberation is not going to involve conversation with white people and sort of equating our experience to them, which sort of flies right in the face of what we were just talking
Everything
about.
Everything we've been saying in this podcast.
But the idea, in here, Lindley talks about the idea that we spend so much time using metaphors to explain Black Lives Matters to them. And, you know, like, oh, if a house was on fire and there wasn't a house on fire, you wouldn't turn the hose on the unfired house and be like, all houses matter, would you? And we keep treating white people as if they did not take the SAT or do reading comprehension just like the rest of us, or take the same histories and civics classes just like the rest of us. It's they understand what's going on. They just can't attend or don't care. And if that's the case, that's fine, you do you. But if we are going to move forward in this country as people of color, we need to stop prioritizing trying to get white people on board, trying to understand our experience, the way that people of color, we are fighting for our lives here. We're fighting for our lives. This is desperation. This is fear. And white people are able to see it from a remove, which fundamentally makes the conversation tilted. So, it was in the Washington Post. I would say just check it out. It makes a lot of sense. And I think for me, this idea has been a journey. I know Trisha's been on me this journey. Like, Trisha, when you think like 23 years ago, remember in college when I was like, we got to talk to all the white people about, you know, I think this has been the end of a long journey. This closes a chapter for me. When I read this article, I was like, this is absolutely right. Like, I am officially done talking to white people about racism. And so check it out. Let me know what you think.
Sounds very interesting.
Wait, so in the end I was right?
I mean, that's one way you can see it.
I know.
I'm gonna say that I evolved, and that
to
you,
where I was,
and you were a stepping stone onto my very personal journey. And with that, Trisha returns to LA tonight.
Yes,
we'll cry, and we will be back together in 2 weeks when we talk about a whole bunch of other stuff. So until then, you guys and listeners, bye.
Bye.